The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 7, Side 1.
I remained there in the modest little amateur theatrical group at the Kaluga Gates, along with Anechka Breslavskaya, Shurochka Ostretsova, and Leova G. We did manage to put on something before they broke us up and sent us away. I now recall my participation in that amateur theatrical activity as a lack of spiritual toughness, as a humiliation. The worthless Lieutenant Mironov, if he had found no other distractions and entertainments in Moscow on a Sunday evening, could come to camp in his cups and give orders. I want a concert in 10 minutes. And the performers were routed out of bed or torn away from the camp hot plate if they happened at that moment to be engaged in cooking with relish something in their mess tins. And in a trice, we would be singing, dancing, and performing on the brilliantly lit stage before an empty hall, in which the only audience was the haughty dolt of a lieutenant and a troika of jailers. Chapter 19. The Czechs as a Nation. An ethnographical essay by Fan Fanich. In this study, if nothing prevents us, we intend to make an important scientific discovery. In the development of our hypothesis, we would in no way wish to come into conflict with the progressive teaching. The author of these lines, attracted by the enigma of the native tribe populating the archipelago, undertook a lengthy scientific expedition there and collected abundant material. And as a result, it is very easy to prove that the Czechs of the archipelago constitute a class of society. For after all, this multitudinous group of many millions has a single, common to them all, relationship to production, namely subordinate, attached, and without any right to direct that production. It also has a single common relationship to the distribution of the product of labor, namely, no relationship at all, receiving only that insignificant share of the products required for the meager support of their own existence. And in addition, all their labor is no small thing, but one of the principal constituents of the whole state economy. You could never say this of the outcasts in Western countries. There they are either languishing in individual isolation, where they do no work whatever, or else there are a few pockets of hard labor whose output has no impact at all on the economy of their country. But our ambition is greater than this. It would be much more sensational to prove that these degenerate creatures, in the past undoubtedly human, are a totally different biological type in comparison with Homo sapiens. Perhaps they are, in fact, the missing link of the theory of evolution. However, these conclusions are not yet ready. Here it will be possible only to offer certain hints to the reader. Imagine that a man is forced suddenly and against his will, yet out of implacable necessity, and without hope of any return, to make a transition into the category of bear or badger. We are not going to employ here that overused image of the wolf. And should it turn out that he proved physically able to make it, and anyone who cashed in his chips would not be in demand there anyway, how could he possibly remain a human being while leading a new life among the badgers? We think he could not, and that he would become a badger. Fur would grow, his snout would lengthen and sharpen, and he would no longer want or need anything cooked or fried, and he would be quite content to bolt things raw.
Picture to yourself that the island environment differs so sharply from the normal human one, and so cruelly confronts a man with the choice of immediate adaptation or immediate death, that it grinds and masticates his character much more thoroughly than could a foreign national or a foreign social environment.
And the only thing it can be compared with is a transmutation into the animal world. But we will postpone this until our next work. Here we will set ourselves only the limited task of proving that the Czechs constitute a special, separate nation. Why is it that classes do not become nations within nations in ordinary life? Because they live commingled on the same territory with other classes. They encounter them on the streets, in stores, on trains and steamers, at theatres and places of entertainment, and they converse and exchange ideas by voice and through the printed word. The Zeks, on the contrary, live totally isolated on their islands, and their life passes in communication solely with one another. The free employers, their chiefs, they in the majority, do not even see, and when they do, they hear nothing from them, except orders and oaths. Their ostracism is made all the more profound by the fact that the majority of them have no clear possibility of ever abandoning this state before death, in other words, of making their way out and up into other, higher classes of society. Who among us did not learn by heart back in secondary school the one and only scientific definition of a nation given by Comrade Stalin, namely, a nation is an historically formed community of people, but one neither racial nor tribal, possessing a common territory, a common language, and a commonly shared economic life, a community of psychological outlook which is manifested in a community of culture. Well now, the natives of the archipelago satisfy all these requirements completely, and even more, too. We are particularly free to reach these conclusions because of Comrade Stalin's brilliant remark that a racial or tribal community of blood is not obligatory at all. Our natives occupy a fully defined common territory, even though it is broken up into islands, but this does not surprise us in the Pacific Ocean, for example, on which other peoples do not live. Their economic way of life is standardized to an astonishing degree. It can, in fact, be described completely and exhaustively on two typewritten sheets of paper, the differential ration system and the directions to the bookkeeping office to credit the Zek's imaginary wages to maintaining the camp compound, the guard, the leadership of the islands, and to the state. If one includes in the economy also the tenor of their daily way of life, then it is uniform on all the islands to such a degree, like nowhere else, that Zeks who have been moved from one island to another are never surprised, do not ask silly questions, and at once set about their affairs flawlessly from the very first. To eat on a scientific basis, to steal whenever you can. They eat food which no one else on earth eats any more. They wear clothes which no one else wears any more. And even their daily schedule is identical on all the islands and obligatory for every Zek. Now, what ethnographer is able to point to any other nation, all of whose members have uniform daily schedules and uniform food and clothing? What is comprehended under the heading of community of culture in the scientific definition of nations? This has been inadequately spelled out for us. We cannot require of the Zeks any unity of science or belles lettres for the simple reason that they have no written language. But then this is also the case with most other island natives, in the majority of cases for lack specifically of culture, but among the Zeks because of superfluity of censorship. At the same time, we hope to be able to demonstrate amply in our essay the Zeks' community of psychology, the uniformity of their day-to-day conduct, even the uniformity of their philosophical views, of which other peoples could only dream, and which is not provided for in the scientific definition of nations. It is in particular their clearly expressed national character that is immediately noted by the scholarly student of the Zeks. They have their own folklore and their own hero images. Finally, they are tightly united by one more corner of culture indissolubly linked with language, and which we can describe only approximately by the pale term Matyorshchina, mother cursing, from the Latin mater. This is that special form of expressing the emotions which is even more important than all the rest of their language, because it permits the Zeks to communicate with one another in a more energetic and briefer form than that provided by the usual linguistic means. The economy of this means of communication compels one to ponder whether it does not contain the rudiments of the language of the future. The permanent psychological state of the Zeks finds its best release and most accurate expression precisely in this highly organized mother cursing, and therefore all the rest of their language seems to recede into the background. But in this, too, we can observe from Kolyma to Moldavia the surprising similarity of expressions representing one and the same linguistic logic. Without special study, the language of the natives of the archipelago is quite as incomprehensible to the outsider as any foreign language. Well, now, how, for example, would the reader understand such expressions as these? Skin the rag. I'm still clicking. Give a glimmer about something. To pick it off a lamppost. Crook with crook and suckers out. Everything said permits us to affirm boldly that the native condition in the archipelago is a special national condition in which the former nationality of a human being is extinguished. We can foresee an objection. They will ask us, is this a people if its ranks are not replenished by the usual method of childbearing? Incidentally, in the one and only scientific definition of nations which we have cited, no such criterion is stipulated. Let us reply. Yes, its ranks are replenished by the technical method of jugging. And out of some strange caprice, its own infants are turned over to neighbouring peoples. However, chicks, after all, are hatched in an incubator, yet we do not for this reason cease to regard them as chickens when we use their meat. But even if some sort of doubt does arise as to how the Zeks begin their existence, at least there can be no doubt whatever as to the method by which they cease to exist. They die, like everyone else, only more densely and more prematurely. And their funeral rite is gloomy, meagre, harsh. Two words about the term Zek itself. Up to 1934, the official term for them was Lishonye Zvobody, deprived of freedom. This was abbreviated to L/S, and no evidence has been preserved, as to whether the natives worked these initials L and S into LSE. But from 1934 on, the term was changed to prisoners, Zakliochunye. Let us recall that the archipelago had begun to harden by then, and even the official language adapted itself to this and could not tolerate there being more freedom than prison in the definition of the natives. And they began to abbreviate the term in the singular Z/K, JK, and in the plural, Z/K, Z/K, ZK, ZK. And this was pronounced very often by the natives' guardians and was heard by all, and all became accustomed to it. But this bureaucratic word could not be declined either by case or by number. It was a worthy offspring of a dead and illiterate epoch. The living ear of the alert natives could not reconcile itself to this situation, and in a spirit of mockery on various islands, in various localities, they began to adapt it for themselves. In some places they said Zaka Kudzmich, or in Norilsk, Zapolyanye Komsomolsi, Arctic Komsomols. In others, for instance Karelia, they tended toward Zak, which was the most correct etymologically, and in others, for instance Inta, they preferred Zik. What I heard was Zek. The old Solovetsky Islands prisoner DSL assures me that as far back as 1931, he heard a convoy guard ask a native, "Who are you, a Zek?" And in all such instances, the new word thus brought to life was declined both by number and by case. But in the Kolyma, insists Shalamov, they adhered in conversation to the official term, Zekka. One can only regret that the Kolyma ear must have been numbed by the cold. The climate of the archipelago is always arctic, even if a particular islet has intruded itself into the southern seas. The climate of the archipelago is 12 months of winter, the rest summer. And the air itself there scorches and pricks one, not only because of the frost, not only because of nature. Even in summer, the Zeks are dressed in the soft grey armour of padded jackets. This in itself, along with the men's cropped scalps, gives them a uniformity of external appearance, smacking of severity in personality. But after observing the Zeks even only a little, you will be equally astonished by the common elements in their facial expressions, always guarded, sullen, without the slightest goodwill, easily slipping into hardness and even cruelty. Their facial expressions look as if they have been cast from a swarthy, copper-coloured material. The Zeks evidently belong to the Indian race. Rough-textured, almost not of flesh, so as to be able to march facing into the wind, expecting at every step to be bitten from the right or the left. You notice also that in action, at work, in a fight, their shoulders are squared and their chests braced for resistance. But as soon as a Zek is left in a state of inaction by himself, buried in his thoughts, his neck ceases to support the weight of his head, and his shoulders and his back immediately express an inveterate stoop, as if he were born with it. The most natural position his hands adopt when free is clasped behind the back if walking, or simply hanging limply when sitting down. His stoop and his depressed air will remain with him when he approaches you, a free person and therefore a possible boss. He will try not to look you in the eyes and will instead look at the ground, but if he is forced to look at you, you will be surprised by his blank, stupid stare, even though it will indicate willingness to carry out your orders. Do not trust it, however. He will not carry them out. If you order him to take off his cap, or if he himself understands he should, his shaven scalp will surprise you unpleasantly, anthropologically, with its bumps, hollows, and asymmetry of a clearly degenerate type. In conversation with you, he will be laconic, speaking without expression, either monotonously and dully, or else with servility, if it is necessary to ask you for something. But if you somehow happen invisibly to overhear the natives when they are talking with one another, you will probably remember forever their special manner of speech, as if pushing the sounds out, maliciously mocking, brusque, and never heartfelt. This is so rooted in the natives that even when a man native is left alone with a woman native, which incidentally is strictly prohibited by the archipelago laws, it is impossible to imagine his ridding himself of that manner of speech. In all probability, he expresses himself to her, too, in a pushy, peremptory sort of way, for it is quite impossible to imagine a Zek speaking tender words. But it is also impossible not to recognize the great energetic force of the Zek's language. In part, this is because it is free of all kinds of superfluous expressions, of introductory phrases such as, pardon me, or please, or if you do not object, and also from superfluous pronouns and interjections. The speech of the Zek moves straight to its goal, just as he himself pushes into the Arctic wind. He speaks as if he were punching his companion in the mug, beating him with words. Just as an experienced fighter invariably tries to knock his enemy off his feet with the very first blow, so the Zek tries to confound his companion, to render him mute, and even to compel him to wheeze from the very first phrase. And he will flatly brush off any question directed at him. Even today, the reader may encounter this repellent manner in unforeseen circumstances. For example, when you are waiting at a trolley bus stop in a strong wind, your neighbor will spill a large hot ash on your new overcoat, threatening to scorch it. You demonstratively brush it off, but he continues to spill ashes on you. And you say to him, "Listen, comrade, how about being more careful with your smoking, eh?" Not only does he not ask your pardon, and not only does he take no precautions with his cigarette, but he barks curtly, "Haven't you any insurance?" And while you are trying to find an answer, you aren't going to find one, he already succeeds in clambering ahead of you onto the trolley bus. Now that is very much like the native manner. Apart from their straight multisyllabic curses, the Zeks evidently have a collection of ready-made expressions which will paralyze any intelligent outside interference and directions. Such expression as, "Don't needle me, I'm of a different religion." "If they're not beating you, don't lie down and ask for it." Here in brackets we have used a substitute for another obscene word, from which the second verb in the phrase also immediately acquires a quite indecent sense. Similar repellent expressions make a particularly indelible impression when coming from the mouths of the native women, since it is they in particular who make the most liberal use of erotically based metaphors. We regret that the bounds of morality do not permit us to embellish this inquiry with still other examples. We will venture to cite just one more illustration of the speed and deftness of the Zecs in the use of language. A certain native named Glick was brought from an ordinary island to a special island, to a secret scientific research institute. Certain natives are naturally developed to such a degree that they are even suitable for conducting scientific research. But because of certain personal considerations, the new and privileged place did not suit him, and he wished to return to his former island. He was summoned before a very high-ranking commission with big stars on their shoulder boards, and there they announced to him, "You are a radio engineer, and we would like to make use of you," without allowing them to finish their sentence with, "in your profession." He straightened up sharply. "Make use of me? So what do you want me to do? Turn around and bend over?" And he reached for his belt buckle and made a motion as if to adopt the indicated position. Naturally, the commission was struck dumb, and there was no deal. Glick was dismissed straight away. It is curious to note that even the natives of the archipelago realize very well indeed that they arouse great interest on the part of anthropologists and ethnographers, and they even brag of this. It seems to increase their value in their own eyes. Among them, there is a widespread, frequently told, legendary anecdote about a certain professor of ethnography, evidently a predecessor of ours, who spent his whole life studying the breed of Zecs and wrote a thick dissertation in 2 volumes in which he came to the final conclusion that the prisoner is lazy, greedy, and sly. At this juncture of the story, both the storyteller and his listeners laugh complacently as though admiring themselves from the sidelines. But soon after, apparently, they jugged the professor himself. This is a very unhappy ending, but since no one is imprisoned in our country unless guilty, then there must have been something to it. Then, after jostling his way through the transit prisons, and when he himself became a last legger on general work, the professor came to understand his error, and to realize that in actual fact, the convict is rowdy, crafty, and transparent. And this is an extremely apt description, and once again one that is somehow flattering. And they all laugh once again. We have already said that the Zecs have no written language, but through the personal example of the veteran islanders, in oral tradition and in folklore, the entire code of correct Zec conduct has been elaborated and is transmitted to newcomers, basic precepts relating to their work, to their employers, to those around them, and to themselves. All this code, taken as a whole, is imprinted on and exemplified in the moral structure of the native, and produces what we can call the Zec national type. The imprint of this affiliation is driven deep inside the human being once and for all. Many years later, if he turns up outside the archipelago, the first thing you will recognize in the human being is the Zec, and only secondarily the Russian, Tatar, or Pole. In the rest of our exposition, we will try to examine here, trait by trait, in complex detail, the constituents of the folk character, the life psychology, and the normative ethics of the nation of Zecs. Attitude toward government work. The Zecs have an absolutely false concept of work as something designed to suck their whole lives from them, which means that their chief salvation is this, while working, not to become absorbed in the work. It is well known to a Zec that you can't do all the work. Never rush, thinking that the sooner you finish, the sooner you can sit down and take a rest. The moment you sit down, you will immediately be given other work to do. Work loves fools. But how do you do it? You flatly refuse to work. That is the worst thing the Zec can do. He will rot in punishment blocks, die of starvation. Going to work is unavoidable. But once there, during the work day, what he has to do is not slog away, but fiddle about. Not bend the back, but loaf gold brick, which is to say, not work anyway. The native will never openly or flatly refuse to perform any order. That would be the end of him. Instead, what he does is stretch the rubber. Stretching the rubber is one of the principal concepts and expressions of the archipelago. This is the Zek's main salvation and achievement. Subsequently widely adopted by the sloggers out in freedom as well. The Zek listens carefully to all the orders he has given and nods his head affirmatively, and he goes off to carry out those orders. But he does not carry them out. Most often of all, he does not even begin. This sometimes leads to despair on the part of the purposeful and inexhaustible commanders of production. And naturally the desire arises to hit him with a fist in the nose or on the back of the neck, this stupid, dumb animal in tatters. After all, he has been told in the Russian language. What doltish obtuseness is this? But that's the point. The Russian language is ill understood by the natives, and a whole series of contemporary concepts such as worker's honour and conscientious discipline have no equivalents in their wretched language. However, no sooner has the chief rushed in for the second time than the Zek obediently bends his back beneath the cursing and immediately begins to carry out the orders. The heart of the employer softens a little, and he goes on with his multitudinous urgent tasks of management, and the Zek behind his back immediately sits down and stops working. If there is no brigadier's fist hanging over his head, if he is not threatened with being deprived of his bread ration today, and also if there is no bait in the shape of time-off sentence. It is difficult for us normal people to understand this psychology, but that is how it is. Obtuseness? Quite the contrary, it is the highest degree of understanding and adaptation to conditions. What can he count on? After all, work does not get done by itself, and if the chief comes around once more, will that be any worse? But here is what he is counting on. Most likely of all, the chief won't come around for the third time today, and you have to survive until tomorrow. Tonight the Zek might be sent off on a prisoner transport, or transferred to another brigade, or put in hospital, or imprisoned in the punishment block, and whatever he has done today will then be credited to someone else. Or tomorrow that same Zek and that same brigade might well be transferred to some other work. Or else the chief might decide that what they were doing isn't necessary, or ought to be done quite differently. And on the basis of many such cases, the Zeks had firmly mastered the truth. Do not do today what you can do tomorrow. Or in Zek lingo, wherever you sit down is where you get off. He is fearful of expending an extra calorie where it maybe doesn't need to be expended. Incidentally, the concept of calories is well known and very popular among the natives. And that is how the Zeks talk frankly among themselves. The one who pulls is the one they urge on. And the one who doesn't, supposedly, is let off with a shrug. In general, the Zek works just to get through the day to the night. But at this point, scholarly integrity obliges us to admit a certain weakness in our course of reasoning. First of all, because the camp rule of the one who pulls is the one they urge on turns out to be simultaneously an old Russian proverb. And we also find in Dal another purely Zekish expression. He lives just to get through the day to the night. Now this coincident arouses a whole whirlwind of thoughts in us. The theory of borrowing, the theory of migratory themes, a school of mythology. Continuing these dangerous comparisons, we find among the Russian proverbs and sayings which took shape under serfdom and were already well established by the 19th century, the following. Don't do the work, don't run from work. Astonishing! This is the very principle of camp rubber. May God grant we know how to do everything, but not do it at all. You will never finish the master's work. A zealous horse doesn't live long. They'll give you a chunk of bread, and for that you'll have to thresh for a whole week. This is very much like the Zek's reactionary theory that even a big bread ration doesn't make up for the expenditure of energy in labour. So, what conclusion is to be drawn from all this? That across all the bright boundary lines of our emancipatory reforms, our enlightenment, our revolutions, and our socialism, the serfs of the Empress Catherine's time, and the Zeks of Stalin's time, notwithstanding their complete dissimilarity in social position, reach out to shake each other's black and horny hands? That is impossible. At this point, our erudition breaks down, and we will return to our exposition. From Zek's relationship to his work, there follows also his relationship to his chiefs. Outwardly, the Zek is very obedient. For example, one of the Zek commandments is, don't stick your neck out. In other words, never talk back to the chiefs. In appearance, the Zek is very much afraid of the chief, bends his back when a chief scolds him or even just stands near him. But in fact, this is a simple calculation to avoid unnecessary punishments. In actual fact, the Zek utterly despises the bosses, both the camp chiefs and the production chiefs, but covertly conceals it so as not to suffer for it. Departing in a throng after any sort of work announcements, reprimands, or official rebukes, the Zeks laugh quietly among themselves. It may have been said, but will manage to forget it. The Zeks inwardly consider themselves to be the superiors of their chiefs, both in literacy and in their mastery of work skills, and in their general level of comprehension of the circumstances of life. And one has to admit that that is often how it is, but here in their self-satisfaction, the Zeks fail to see that, on the other hand, the administration of the islands possesses a permanent superiority over the natives by virtue of its world outlook. That is why the naive concept of the Zeks that the chief's principles are I do as I please, or the law here is me, is really quite unfounded. However, this gives us a convenient opportunity to draw a distinction between the native status and the old Russian serfdom. The serf peasant did not like his nobleman owner and made fun of him, but had grown accustomed to feeling something superior in him, as a result of which there was a multitude of characters like Savelich and Fierce who were dedicated slaves. But now this spiritual slavery has ended once and for all, and among the tens of millions of Zeks it is quite impossible to imagine even one who sincerely worships his chief. And in this respect there is an important national difference between the Zeks and your and my compatriots, dear reader. The Zeks do not strive for praise, nor for honorary diplomas, nor to have their names posted on red bulletin boards of honor, unless these are directly tied in with supplementary rations. Everything that is called the glory of labor out in freedom is for the Zeks, in their stupidity, only a dull and hollow sound. In this, they are all the more independent of their guardians and of the necessity to please. As a generalization, the entire scale of values is topsy-turvy among the Zeks, but this need not surprise us if we recall that it is always that way among savages. For a tiny little mirror, they are willing to part with a big fat pig. For cheap little beads with a basket of cocoa beans. Those things that are precious to us, dear reader, such as ideological values, self-sacrifice, dedication, and the desire to labor selflessly for the future, these are not only quite absent among the Zeks, but are even considered worthless. It is enough to say that the Zeks are totally deprived of patriotic sentiment, and do not like their own native islands in the least. Let us recall the words of their own folk song. Be thou damned, O Kolyma, snakes invented this planet. Because of this, they rarely undertake long and risky journeys in search of happiness, which are called, in their dialect, escapes. Most highly esteemed of all among the Zeks, occupying first place in terms of the value placed on it, is the bread ration, a piece of black bread with additives in it, badly baked, which you and I would be unwilling to eat. And among the Zeks, the bigger and heavier the ration is, the more precious it is. Anyone who has ever seen the greed with which the Zeks hurl themselves on their morning bread ration, almost devouring their hands along with it, will have a difficult time ever erasing that unaesthetic recollection from his mind. Second place among them is occupied by makorka, or homegrown tobacco, and the rates of exchange involving these things are wildly arbitrary and don't pay the least heed to the amount of socially useful labor invested in the one or the other. This is all the more monstrous in that among them makorka occupies the place, so to speak, of a universal currency. There is no monetary system on the islands. Third place is occupied by gruel, which is an island soup without fats, without meat, without grits or vegetables, in accordance with native custom. Probably even the marching of grenadiers on parade in exact step with one another, in gleaming uniforms and flourishing weapons, does not leave such a fearsome impression on the viewer as does the evening entry of a brigade of Zeks into the mess hall to get their gruel. Those shaven heads, those slapdash caps, tatters tied together with strings, those mean, crooked faces. How do they get those muscles and sinews from that gruel? And in they go, with 25 pairs of shoes and rope and bast sandals. Tup, 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 left, right, give us our ration, bosses. Anyone who's not of our faith, get out of the way. And on the 25 faces at the moment of seizing their prey, the national character of the Zeks is disclosed to you distinct and clear. We note the fact that in reaching conclusions about the Zeks, we can hardly imagine them as individuals, their separate personalities and names, but that is not a fault of our method. It is a reflection of that herd structure of life in which this outlandish people lives, renouncing family life and the creation of heirs, which are so traditional among other peoples. They are convinced that their population will be replenished by other means. This collective way of life is extremely characteristic of the archipelago, be it an inheritance from primitive society or the dawn of the future. Probably it is the future. The next most highly valued thing among the Zeks is sleep. A normal human being can only be astounded at how much a Zek is capable of sleeping and in what varied circumstances. One hardly need say that insomnia is quite unknown among them. They take no sleeping pills. They sleep every night through without waking. And if they happen to get a day free of work, they sleep right through it. It has been reliably established that they are able to fall asleep when seated beside empty hand barrows while the latter are being loaded. They are able to fall asleep out at line-up with their legs spread wide apart. And they are also able to fall asleep even when marching under guard to work. But not all of them. Some of them keel over and wake up. And the basis of all this is, during sleep, the sentence passes more quickly. And in addition, the night is for sleep, and the day is for rest. It is paradoxical, but the Russian people have similar proverbs. I eat while I'm marching and sleep while I'm standing. Where there's a nook or cranny, there's a bed. Let us return to the image of the brigade stamping in to get its lawful, as they call it, gruel. We see an expression here of one of the principal national traits of the Zek people, vital drive. Nor does this contradict their inclination to keep dropping off to sleep. That is, in fact, why they sleep, so as to have the strength for their drive in the interim. This drive is both literal and physical, and continues right up to the finish line of their goals. Food, a warm stove, a clothes dryer, shelter from the rain. And in all that pushing and shoving, the Zek does not hesitate to stick his shoulder in his neighbor's side, and if two Zeks are going to pick up a tree trunk, both of them head for the top end, so that the other will get the thick end. And this drive exists in a more general sense, a drive to get the most advantageous position in life. In the cruel island conditions, so close to the conditions of life in the animal kingdom that we can, without fear of contradiction, apply here the Darwinian struggle for life. Life itself often depends on success or failure in the struggle for a place, and in driving a path for oneself at the cost of others, the natives acknowledge no restraining ethical principles. They themselves say, straight out, "Conscience? It got left in my case file." In taking vital decisions, they are guided by the well-known rule of the archipelago. It is better to be a son of a bitch than to suffer. But this drive can be successful only if it is accompanied by practical agility and resourcefulness in the most difficult situations. The Russians say, he bows with his front, watches out with his side, and feels his way with his rear. The Zek has to manifest this quality every day for the simplest and the most insignificant purposes, to safeguard his pitiful dregs of property, some dented mess tin, stinking rags, a wooden spoon, his handy needle. However, in the struggle for an important position in the island hierarchy, even this resourcefulness must become calculated trickery of a superior, more subtle, more ingenious order. So as not to weigh down this inquiry, here is one example. A certain Zek managed to secure the important position of chief of the camp workshops. Certain kinds of work were successfully carried out in his workshops, and others not. But the strength of his position depended not so much on the successful completion of his work as on his ability to bluff. Some MVD officers came to his office and saw some ceramic cones on his desk. "What are they?" "Seeger cones. What are they for?" "To determine the temperature inside the ovens." "Aha," drawled out the chief, thinking to himself, "Well, I certainly put a good engineer in the job." But those cones could not be used to determine temperatures through their melting point because they weren't made of standardized clay and their composition was unknown. The cones started to become overfamiliar, and soon the chief of the workshops had a new toy on his desk, an optical instrument without a single lens. Where in the archipelago would you find a lens? And again, everyone was astounded. And the Zek's mind had continually to be occupied with such sideways feints as these. According to the circumstances and his psychological appraisal of the enemy, the Zek had to demonstrate flexibility of conduct, ranging from a crude move with fist or voice up to the most delicate kind of pretense, from total shamelessness to sacred fidelity to a promise given face to face, which one would not think to be at all compulsory. Thus, for some reason, all Zeks were as faithful as saints to their promises of secret bribes, and exceptionally patient and conscientious in carrying out private commissions. When we see some wonderful archipelago handicraft work with carving and inlays, the likes of which can otherwise be seen only in the Ostankino Museum, it is impossible to believe that this was done by those same hands which turned over to the foreman work that was held together only by a peg so that it would fall apart immediately. This flexibility of conduct was also reflected in the famous Zek rule, "If they give, take it. If they beat, beat it." The most important condition of success in the life struggle of the Gulag Islanders is their secretiveness. Their character and their intentions are so profoundly hidden that to the inexperienced novice employer, it seems at the outset as if the Zeks bend like a blade of grass beneath the wind and the boot. Compare the proverb of the Russians, "It is better to bend than to break." Only subsequently does he become bitterly convinced of the cunning and insincerity of the islanders. Secretiveness is almost the most characteristic trait of the Zek tribe. The Zek has to hide his intentions and acts, both from the employers and from the jailers, and from the brigadiers and from the so-called stoolies. An insignificant phenomenon of the archipelago, upon which we consider it superfluous to dwell in this essay. He has to conceal his successes so that they will not be outdone. He has to conceal his plans, his calculations, and his hopes, whether he be preparing for a big escape or has figured out where to collect shavings for a mattress. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.